here we are at the dessert and we know nothing about each other. You won't tell me your name. You won't even let me tell you mine.
Oh, dear. Didn't we settle all that at the soup and again at the salad? Why spoil such a perfect evening with names?
Welcome to Season 5 of How Would Lubitsch Do It, a podcast in which we discuss the works of director Ernst Lubitsch, one film at a time. It's 1937, and Chris Cassingham joins us to discuss Angel. Come visit ErnstCast.com if you'd like show notes, resources as to where you might find the films we'll be discussing, a link to our Discord, or just to say hi. Hey everyone, we're here with Chris Cassingham. Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Like you said, my name is Chris. What I'm doing now with my life is a mixture of film curation and film programming and some criticism with contemporary nonfiction. I also do a lot of programming with new micro-budget American cinema. And yeah, I wanted to come on this podcast. I mean, I emailed you out of the blue. I got many months ago because I'm a huge fan of Lubitsch. I'm an ardent fan of, you know, classical Hollywood, kind of as an escape from the kind of immediacy in terms of what I generally program and work with. And yeah, so I emailed you out of the blue telling you just like that I was a fan of the podcast because it was in its early days at that point. And that if you didn't have anyone booked yet, I would love to.
You demanded Angel. I demand Angel.
I sort of demanded Angel. I guess we'll call it that. Yeah, I demanded to do Angel because, and this is something I think I'll definitely talk about a little bit more, is that it's probably my favorite movie of all time. And in those months since we, you know, first got in touch, I've gone on quite a journey with this film. But yeah, it just holds a really special place in my heart. So I had a few opportunities to do some kind of like professional work with the film. I introduced a screening in London because it is rarely screened kind of in cinemas. Mm-hmm. So I, again, sort of put myself forward and asked if I could introduce the screening in London, and they kindly said yes. So yeah, so I've just sort of been on a journey with this film, and this is kind of a culmination, I guess.
You're in good company with a few other guests, and one of the most rewarding parts of this podcast has been people coming to me and going, hey, I know everyone's going to ask for Trouble in Paradise or Shop Around the Corner or To Be or Not to Be, but my favorite movie ever made, or my favorite American movie, whatever, is this film that you would have never suspected. And I mean, the first one of those was Matt Severson demanded 1 hour with You, which is his favorite American film.
Amazing.
And with you and Angel, and I know that Lady Windermere's fan, Dave Kerr, considers that one of, you know, the silent masterpieces for all time. And, you know, those are all films I would never have expected. So this is one of my favorite genres of episodes is let's talk about your favorite that isn't necessarily a film that is on everyone else's radar. Mm-hmm. I mean, my own entry into this canon is The Merry Widow, which is oftentimes tied for my favorite Lubitsch film.
Wow.
Even though I think it's monstrously underappreciated.
Yeah.
It's probably my favorite musical. So Angel, and I'm curious, let's start with, you know, there's a lot of stuff we can talk about. This film is a lot of interesting stylistic bits, but what I want to start with is, I want your thoughts. What about Angel sets it apart from other Lubitsch movies? Because as you mentioned, it's rarely shown, and part of the sense I get as to why it's rarely shown is that from the surface, you kind of look at it and go, I'm kind of embodying the voice of an outside observer, which is maybe me 5 years ago, might have watched this film and gone, well, this is good. It's fine. It's clearly a well-made movie, but maybe it doesn't have the twists of To Be or Not to Be. There's no Nazis. There's no communism as in Ninotchka. There's no Maurice Chevalier spiking the camera as in all of his movies. What about Angel sets it apart from the rest for you?
In a way, you kind of answered it. It's kind of its own special entity. And in some of your episodes from previous seasons, we talk about these sort of Lubitsch dramedies. And Angel is absolutely one of them. I think the first time I heard you maybe say that explicitly was when the episode about Three Women, which at the time of recording came out about a week and a half ago. So yeah, it is like you said, it doesn't have the sort of outrageous antics of To Be or Not to Be. It doesn't have the garbo laughs that Ninotchka has. It doesn't have the sort of bold, extravagant color that like Heaven Can Wait has. It is just a really surprisingly subdued, oblique, understated, yet I think I find it really poignant and really complex genesis of a new era of his filmmaking. And I think that's probably an aspect of this film that we'll talk about a little bit more, is just what this film represents, not as just like a film, but also as a point in Lubitsch's career, which I think is not quite as interesting as the film, but really interesting as a piece of history.
To get into that history, I mean, the first three films we're covering this season, which are Desire, This, and Bluebeard's Eighth Wife, there's a common theme, not within the films, but in the historical context, which is all three of these films see Lubitsch reckoning with two things. One is the gap between 1934 and 1937 in his own career, where he became production head of Paramount. We covered that in previous episodes already. And also with the advent of a massive sea change in the mainstream American comedy style. You know, this is the era of Screwball. This is the era of the Hays Code, where the interplay between men and women especially was less about sex overtly and more about things like career and marriage and things that were a little more acceptable. And that kind of, you know, played into this more kind of brash, what we might call American, you know, rugged, individualistic American class-based often comedy that characterized Screwball. And, you know, Bluebeard's Eighth Wife, spoiler alert, we're going to see Lubitsch try and attempt a Screwball. But that is the polar opposite of this film in so many ways. This is almost Lubitsch going, oh, you're all doing that? Well, let me retrench. Let me go deeper into my little hole. Let me cut off all the parts of me that even resemble Screwball. It's a film that signals a bigger shift in his overall style. Probably the biggest one since his transition from a Berlin director to a Hollywood director. Mm-hmm. When, you know, you have the 1, 2, 3 of The Flam, Rosita, and Marriage Circle that just were two huge jumps. But this is just as big as one of those. And so we have Lubitsch making a film that is almost about the void. It's about the space between the text.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Angel is so, like we said, subdued and oblique and low key. It's in like a minor key and yet still retains like those signature Lubitsch inflections that even though this is such a kind of a big departure stylistically, even and tonally and even visually, it still remains like so 100% Lubitsch.
What's different here? What's actually changed?
Lubitsch was so perfect for pre-code because he has such a sophisticated sensibility about, you know, sex and marriage and the interplay between the genders. When given the freedom to really explore them pretty explicitly, he just flourished. But that sophistication transferred over to this post-code era in which everything has to be sublimated under, you know, innuendo and kind of repression. I mean, it is an era of repression. So having someone as sophisticated and intelligent as Lubitsch and his collaborators is a real asset when you have to, you know, find workarounds to still talk about and express the complexities of marriage and married life and romance and sex that, you know, Lubitsch was interested in throughout his whole career. Part of that is represented by, I think, kind of the pared down visuals of Angel. The Merry Widow is an extravagant MGM musical that had, I think, fully settled into the sound. It was 1934. So by then, everyone had figured out how to do it. And I mean, and Lubitsch was one of the first ones to really understand sound. I mean, in 1929 and 1930, when some of those early sound films you just can barely get through, Lubitsch was up and running. So by 1934, he was, I don't know, probably way ahead of the field. And so the camera was so mobile, it was flying around. You have these insane zooms. You have Maurice Chevalier doing his thing. And the camera sort of makes use of that. In Angel, I think in line with the restrictions on what they could say and talk about and express, the film is much more subdued. The camera movements are a bit more logical and matter of fact. They're still elegantly done. I mean, always elegantly done. Lubitsch always had an eye and a sophisticated taste for how to bring the camera into sort of mundane situations that was still engaging and, I don't know, thought-provoking. I think Angel's really, its beauty and its kind of style is characterized by just kind of a complete mastery of how to operate within a highly restricted kind of set of rules of filmmaking.
I think one of the clearest examples of this shift in context lies in The Whip Pants. This film has, or I'm going to start with The Merry Widow. The Merry Widow is a film where, you know, there are numerous whip pants. And there's one especially that I want to highlight, which is when Danilo goes to Maxime's and it whip pans from A wide shot of the Maxine's dancers in the middle of the dance floor. Whip pan, Danilo enters, arm in arm with a dozen women. He's a flock of ladies. In the context of The Merry Widow, that whip pan is an expression of the tone of that scene in that moment and the dominant tone of the film as a whole. This exuberance, the film has a little overtone of sadness, of loss, but it's dominated by this joie de vivre. And in the case of that film, the whip pan is this, joyous moment of ecstasy. It's, look at how exciting this is. Isn't this incredible? Wow, Danilo with all these ladies and they're going to Maxime's. And in this film, there are exactly two whip pans. The first of these is when Melvin Douglas first enters Marlene Dietrich's life. When Tony first enters Maria, or at this point, Angel's life. She enters the salon, whip pans over to Melvin Douglas. This is a rupture. This is a huge break in her life. It is upsetting the status quo. The tone of the film is this dour thing. The whip pan is acting against the tone of the film. The second whip pan is a whip pan to the telegram. As it enters towards the end, the telegram that first kind of cues the, up to this point, completely oblivious Herbert Marshall, Frederick, cues him to his wife's infidelity. And so, at least an emotional affair. In this case, the whip pan, it has the exact opposite function of that of The Merry Widow. The whip pan acts as a rupture within the film's formal aesthetic, which is otherwise incredibly, almost like obstinately clamped down. I mean, it's full of these long still shots. I mean, you have that, I always say famous scene, but it's only famous to me in like the book I read it in. The famous scene where you have that lovely line where Maria is pretending to be the Grand Duchess to Melvin, and she is saying, hey, can I arrange you a dinner party? She's kind of putting on the act, right? She says,
a nice large party.
Not too large.
Six? Four? Two?
Two is the best suggestion.
That whole scene, we hold on Melvin Douglas's face, not reacting. And that stillness is where the content of the scene lies. That's where the meat of the scene is. And we don't cut away from that. Even when in any other film, we'd have probably a two shot or a reverse if it was a more conventional filmmaker than Lubitsch. But no, he sticks on the lack of response on his face because he knows that's the most important thing we're looking at in the scene. But it also fits into the film's overall aesthetic of just utter stillness. And, the framing is open. I mean, I could go on for hours about this, but I'll cut myself on this. There's also the kind of extensive use of closed framing by Charles Lang, the cinematographer, where compare this to, for example, The Merry Widow or Bluebeard's Eighth Wife. Generally, in those films, you will get, and I name those two because those are the adjacent movies. In those two films, generally in a two-shot, even a tight two-shot, you'll see the head and shoulders of the characters. They will only merge with the border on one, maybe two sides. Merge with the frame edge, I mean. In this film, characters merge with the frame edge on three and four sides constantly. It almost feels like they placed the camera and then went on a focal length that was 30% longer than they would otherwise. It almost feels like Lubitsch is constructing a film with a series of like obstructions for himself formally to achieve the sense of intense intimacy and just smoldering cloisteredness. Anyways, I'll stop my rant now, but boy, there's a lot of interesting stuff here.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I mean, what the things you're talking about are as direct as can be a correlation to, kind of what's the text of this film, what's going on in this film, what's going on in the relationships between these three people. I mean, there was something that William Paul said in his book that you had excerpts from his book that you sent me. We're talking about the meeting. The luncheon meeting between the three characters, between Maria, Mr. Barker, and Tony. This film leads up to this sort of what should be in any other film, a sort of emotionally explosive sort of reunion clash of lovers. In Angel, though, in the hands of Lubitsch, it is the most meticulously polite and, again, I mean, we're going to use this word to death, but subdued approach to, tampering down, putting a lid on extreme, anxiety, shock, disappointment, a mixture of so many things that these characters must be thinking, especially since Tony had mere seconds before discovered who Herbert Marshall's wife was, the angel. So yeah, so this climactic meeting is filmed with such, with such delicacy and care, and it's all about this film is about hiding pain, right? I mean, Maria's constantly hiding and trying to navigate this sort of pain that she's feeling about a marriage that isn't fulfilling her anymore. A marriage that, at least to me, she is quite clearly she wants to work. She's very much in love with her husband, and yet something is not working. You know, we come to learn throughout that it's her husband's sort of devotion to his slightly obscure diplomatic work.
It really feels like a sort of auteurist experiment.
Mm.
I wrote this as a provocation for myself, so I do not stand by these words, but this feels like Lubitsch's Vertigo, in the sense of it is a film that is about his defining features as an auteur and his own relationship to his cinema. You know, Vertigo, I don't need to go into that too much. I mean, if you're listening to this podcast at this point, listeners, you're probably familiar with the things about Hitchcock that Vertigo is about, but this is a film about obscurity. It's a film about withholding. I mean, almost every major plot beat we are not privy to. My favorite example is that when Melvin Douglas, Tony, he enters, and I mean, this film is a convoluted plot. You know, I'm assuming that if you're listening to this, you might have watched it, but if you haven't, you have this Marlene Dietrich knows these two men, her husband and this man she just met last week while she was incognito in Paris. And it turns out that her kind of lover for one night, whether emotional or physical, is an old war buddy of her husband. And so you have these three different relationships between these three different characters. All three of these dimensions are very, very different and very cloistered from each other. Melvin Douglas does not realize that he has essentially had an affair with his close friend's wife for the longest time. And this reveal is drawn out. Lubitsch teases us with it forever and ever to the point when we cannot wait to see it. I, you know, even on this viewing, knowing that it would be withheld, I went, oh, I can't wait to, come on, find it, you know, and then you have this slow dolly into a picture that we know is of Marlene Dietrich. And we hear Melvin Douglas motioning towards it. Mm-hmm. And then we cut away. And by the time we next see him, he has long since internalized and accepted this and moved on to the next phase of his train of thought. And to me, I mean, that is next level withholding. But to tie all this into the actual thematics of the film, though, the film is basically, I mean, I think it's primarily a character study of Angel, hence, you know, the title. It's a character study of Maria, Marlene Dietrich, and her, you know, and I kind of keep calling her these names because she's kind of all three of these things at once. She's the star Marlene Dietrich, she's Angel, and she's Maria. And she's compartmentalized herself so emotionally that no matter what, she is the mask. You know, and this is something that we hear a lot about Dietrich, right? She has a mask of a face. Her face hides an inner maybe vulnerability, maybe an inner toughness, depending on the role. People read into it. But in this case, the film is about her obscurity and it is about her indirectness.
Yeah.
By the end of the film, I'm questioning, who is this person? Is Angel her true self? Is Maria her true self? Or is it just the case where she's a Peter Sellers type, where, you know, she has a sort of inability to embody one true self at any given time, that she has no true self? And that really speaks to me to Lubitsch's cinema, of this question of, is his cinema a lot of artifice and indirection in service of a substance, or is it in service of the indirectness itself? And this is a case where it feels like those are one. The substance is the indirectness because it's about a character that is indirect. And so the film is this weird recursive thing that is formally about itself.
Yeah, that's an amazing way to put it. I mean, and those are ideas that I hadn't even really been able to articulate in such a way. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially in terms of what you said about the indirectness being the either or-ness of the indirectness. Is it, in, like you said, in service of like the substance and the complexity of the character, or is it for itself, which is, you know, just as fun sometimes? But I think there is, yeah, just a beautiful, I don't know, synergy between these two approaches that is what makes Angel endlessly watchable to me. But yeah, if we want to talk about Maria, Marlena, Angel, like, I think this is like a great time to do that now, because
absolutely,
I think this is one of, I haven't seen all of her films. I mean, for sure she made tons of films, but like, this is, I think, one of her best performances. And it's partly because both Lubitsch and her, I mean, she's in on this. She's part of this process. He's very collaborative. So there's no way she wasn't kind of aware of kind of all the tricks and tools they were using to kind of like tease out this performance. They make such intelligent use of Marlena's own, I don't know, multifaceted kind of anonymity, if that makes any sense. She's like a woman of so many things, yet she's also no one, and she's Marlene Dietrich, if that makes any sense. I mean, these are like such obscure, like kind of weird, formless ideas.
I don't know if you've seen Dishonored, but it feels of a piece with that, where that's about a character whose identity kind of shifts depending on her context. And it kind of ends on a note of, like, is her life a performance? Is she unable to set apart the performative aspects of who she is and her whatever, quote unquote, true self might be?
The ending of Dishonored couldn't be more directly asking those questions. I mean, she's like, can you bring me my my outfit that, you know, I was wearing at the beginning of this film? And she has her cat with her. And like,
let me
and
put
she,
on my lipstick as I get shot.
Put on her lipstick. And she has her the signature pose that she's even doing in Angel with the hand on the hip. It was something I noticed because I did watch Dishonored quite recently, kind of in preparation for this, wanting to see more of her Sternberg performances. There's a point, I can't remember exactly what the context of the scene is anymore, but she's carrying a bunch of bottles and I think pieces of paper. It's so absurd, but it's such a brilliant piece of character work, because instead of using both arms to, I don't know, carry this kind of burdensome load of bottles and papers, she awkwardly stuffs them underneath one arm so she can have her other arm on her hip. It's absurd and it makes no logical sense, but it is so perfect for the character slash Marlena Dietrich, because that's a bit of Marlena coming in through the character, or a bit of Marlena being utilized for the character, or them becoming one. And you see that happen. She's always got her hand on her hip in Angel, even though, you know, they're on the surface such different characters.
It's interesting to see this film in context of this is in the midst of Lubitsch's attempted rebranding of her. Desire is, I think, a successful rebrand in that she really, I think, she's a legitimate comic actress in that. And what a failure of a rebrand this movie is. You know, this doubles down on her obscurity and her iciness. You know, again, it perfectly serves the film. I think it's a great performance. I agree with you. It's one of her best. But on an economic level, this actually feels like a bizarrely out of character film for Lubitsch in that way. Where this film feels like designed to be uncommercial, even with how it deals with Dietrich.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it plays out, you know, real terms soon after this when she was, you know, famously labeled box office poison, which, I mean, talk about strange coming up after both of those actors' possibly best performances in, obviously, in Angel and then Katharine Hepburn in Stage Door. It is so, you know, so interesting that for a man who had, you know, spent the previous year as the head of a production at Paramount, that he would take such a, I don't know, financial gamble in doubling down on Marlena Dietrich's unknowability.
It's one of the few times when it feels like artistic legitimacy and commercial viability were truly at odds in Lubitsch's career. That's the exception for him, which makes him an exception among auteurs.
I do wonder how much I like to think he was kind of reveling in it, because maybe it is like, maybe it is a bit of a middle finger to Paramount after, you know,
it feels like it.
Sort of an unceremonious 2 years as the head of production in which he had no real hits, and Desire, which to me personally, I don't think a very satisfying film. I wonder if how much he was seeing Angel at the time as a sort of middle finger to be like, you know what, I'm gonna go out of left field here and do something so almost unrecognizable. I mean, I'm sure it must have felt so strange to people, to audience, contemporary audiences. We have the remove of, you know, 85 years at this point, knowing that, like, well, yes, this might have been a departure, felt like a departure at the time, but we see all the signatures because we've had decades of, you know, scholarship.
There's a lot of hindsight. Yeah. It's really interesting how this and Bluebeard's Eighth Wife are such a kind of interregnum where, regardless of our feelings about the artistic merit of this film, this and Bluebeard's Eighth Wife were a real risky time for Lubitsch. You have this, and then as you mentioned, that this is him, you know, kind of going, okay, I'm going to dig myself deeper here. And then Bluebeard's Eighth Wife is, I think, overtly reactionary. It's him going, well, that didn't work. Let's try this. That worked even less. You know, and strangely enough, I mean, he bombs out of Paramount. And for some reason, I'm still a little amazed that he rallied for Ninotchka, which was a make work project for the film he really wanted to do. And that film heralded the kind of second great classic period of his career.
Yeah.
You know, where with one exception, basically, you have a string of, and that one exception I think is underrated, which is that certain feeling. You have a string of, I think, masterpiece, at the very least, great cinema.
Yeah.
Basically unbroken except for his health problems.
Yeah.
He truly doesn't know what to do here. And that's part of what makes this such an exciting film.
You put it really well. And I like to think, because his films are so mischievous often, I do like to think that he was, you know, like Maria, the character in the film, just reveling at times in provocation. That's another aspect of the, you know, Marlena's character in this film that I find so refreshing and interesting, is that at almost all times, she seems to be provoking the men in her life and taking delight in doing so. It is such a fascinating approach to take at this time with a, you know, a female character in a film that is so definitively about and for her, to make her so active and direct in her, I don't know, poking at the men in her life to, you know, get reactions to them. Because that is, again, essentially what she's fighting in this film, is like kind of the staleness, you know, state of her marriage.
Yeah.
She's trying to like poke some life back into it. And you can see that all of these techniques that we've been talking about that are departures, yet so totally of his style, are in their own way the same kind of provocations to an industry that maybe had gotten used to him, that maybe he was hoping, he was obviously trying to do a rebrand maybe for himself and for Marlena. That so like these provocations are just are so integral to, again, like the themes of the film and kind of its broader, I guess, industrial context, which I find really interesting.
You said something there that I think is very astute, where, you know, this idea that she wants to break out of the staleness of the relationship. And in a way, you know, it's unclear whether her affair with Melvin Douglas feels genuine in the sense of she obviously feels an attraction, but to her, it almost serves this function of shaking up her own stasis. And that really puts this film in line with other films like One Hour with You, Trouble in Paradise, you know, films that where an affair basically shakes a rote relationship to life.
Yeah.
And also your point about her provoking the man in her life, that really culminates with the ending, doesn't it? Where Herbert Marshall is desperate to know whether she's Angel. She's gone all the way to Paris, way out of character, done something unexpected. And she, you can tell she's a bit impressed, but she basically goes, in that room is a woman who may or may not be me. If there's no one there, you know it's me. If there's someone there, you know it's not me. And I did not have an affair.
If you don't go in at all, you'll be a little uncertain. You won't be quite so sure of yourself. Or of me. And that might be wonderful.
And she basically provokes him to say, to quote a serious man, accept the mystery. Right.
Yeah.
And it almost feels like, I mean, William Paul and James Harvey both have kind of separate but parallel readings here, which is James Harvey characterizes it as a man who temporarily loses his elegance, that's Herbert Marshall, and then rallies and recaptures it. And then William Paul describes it as a sort of victory of obliqueness, where she basically is challenging Herbert Marshall. Hey, you want to know everything. You are a concrete man. You are completely without mystery in your life now. And you want to kill this mystery. Keep the mystery alive and I'll stay with you, basically. And he then, you know, the unlikely part is he goes in and there's a beautiful shot. I love that it's revealed in the wide shot. It's a static wide shot of the whole room. The truth is in the void. The truth is in nothing's there. And then he leaves the room, and the twist of the film, the big twist, is that he finds a way to recapture the mystery by force of rhetoric and will. James Harvey says, regains his elegance.
You see, Maria, in the last few moments, I thought more about our married life than in all the years we've been together. And all I know is the train to Vienna leaves at 10.
I'm going to, you know what? I realized I've been wrong. I'm going to reintroduce mystery into our relationship. And by basically denying reality. And so he does. He regains his aura by choice instead of by lack of choice, by his own agency. It's really interesting.
There could be a whole episode, I think, on this final sequence of scenes in the salon in Paris at the end of the film. She also says, crucially in there, is that if you go in there, regardless of what you find, I hope you're satisfied because our marriage as you know it is over.
Now, Frederick, if you go into that room, I'm afraid our marriage is over. If you find Angel in there, you'll be happy that I'm not Angel, and you'll want to continue our old life. That would not be satisfactory to me.
Her wording I love, which is, that won't satisfy me, she says, right? Because the only satisfaction for her is in her, in a different film, it feels like she's asking for a leap of faith from him. That's how I read it the first time, actually. I watched it, was that she's asking for for his blind faith. But what she's really doing is, yeah, asking for ambiguity.
I can see why this ending is really tough for some people. Because, yeah, I mean, I think an extremely ungenerous reading of this film, which I think Scott Amon gives it, is that, like he calls Angel reactionary. I can see if you're in a foul mood, how that perspective makes sense. I mean, it is a sort of, in one light, this total rejection of this mystery. If you take everything kind of at its surface, which, I mean, Maria asks for him to not worry about the mystery and in fact embrace the mystery about who she is and has been. And he obviously by going into the room, disregards that in favor of knowing exactly what's happening. And the compromise is that when the film ends, they're back together. And I can see how that's super unsatisfying, because the delight of the film has been in the mystery and in the gray areas. And the film seemingly abandons that for a, quote, Hollywood happy ending. But I'm not even myself totally resolved on it. But I think there is just so much more going on that you can't possibly just leave it at that. Yeah, the ending to me is so rich. And I mean, and one of the central kind of questions about why I think this is so, I mean, this film is so rad, is that she asks extremely bluntly, it's like,
don't I have a lovely home, a celebrated husband, the best servants, every comfort, social position? Is there anything more a woman could ask? Why should I be Angel? What reason could I have? Perhaps you can think of one.
What an incredible provocation in 1937. That floors me every time. It's so direct.
The most direct version of that, too, is when they have their mock argument, right? When they're talking about what to argue about. And she basically explicitly says her own hangouts about the marriage in a hypothetical. And then they diffuse one another's kind of honesty. So, you know, that implication that the only way they can be honest to each other is by putting on this facade.
And it's so great, because then, they do confront it by the end with real honest directness, while still leaving up like the desire and space to embrace the ambiguity and the mystery. There's nothing solid about how this film ends. And I think that's what's great.
I think a lot of the things about the film that keep me at a distance paradoxically pull me in. The film is kind of about the labor it takes to keep a relationship going. You know, we're meeting a couple in medias res in the midst of a place when the work of maintaining this relationship has not been done. And I'm talking very concretely here, but the film is really about how two people kind of recommit to working on that relationship. And for a film so indirect, that has very indirect emotional resonance for me. And yeah, I think a lot of people in long-term relationships, which is not, you know, not uncommon, you know, long-term relationships, people have them. But where my thoughts on the film are almost self-contradictory is in that distance the film creates, because the way this film treats, for example, the destabilizing excitement, danger of this affair with Trouble in Paradise, where Trouble in Paradise, the affair between Kay Francis and Marshall again, is so exciting. It's an incredibly erotic film. It's a film that, again, you get this practically fireworks on the screen whenever they're together and talking. If they're talking about make the check out to cash, there's so much romantic tension, and you really, really want them to be together, even while you want Herbert Marshall to be with Lily. In this case, there's never a point in Angel when I feel 0.1% of that crackling energy between Melvin Douglas and Marlene Dietrich. It's a different type of energy, a more distancing one. It's this almost more intellectualized energy. And that has a, you know, we've talked about the ways that really serves the movie, but in one specific way, I find, yet I never really have any emotional investment in, you know, the possibility of Douglas and Dietrich being together. And conversely, not a ton of investment in Marshall and Dietrich. This film feels like an incredibly, I don't want to call it an intellectual exercise, because I feel emotions while watching it, but they're so diffuse in an interesting way.
I'm 100% in line with you. Like, all of this is resonating with me. And it's something William Paul talks about. William Paul says it's possible to be both calculating and emotionally engaged at the same time. And I think that's such a crucial point to make about the entire film. And I guess in some ways ties to why I feel like this is a pretty feminist film as well, is that the actual investment is in, just at least for me, it's in Maria herself. I feel it all for her. And I want her sort of journey of provocation, of calculation, and sincere kind of emotional, I don't know, turmoil and engagement with both of these men to, I don't know, to culminate into something satisfying for her. And I think maybe that ending leaves that up for debate, but it's all about her. It's not about, like, really, not really about either of these relationships. It's about Maria for me.
Hence the title.
I think to a lot of people, both of these relationships are less than satisfactory. Lubitsch is smart enough to know that that's kind of the point, in a way.
To kind of tie it into Lubitsch's personal life too, he was in the midst of a marriage that at this point was already unhappy. And I can't help but think that a lot of these films from this period, I mean, think of all the films from this period that deal with unhappy marriages. You have this, Bluebeard's Eighth Wife.
To an extent, Heaven Can Wait.
Heaven Can Wait, Shop Around the Corner, deals with, that's the one time where an affair in the whole Lubitsch canon feels like a real evil deed. as opposed to a deed that is ranges from exciting to necessary evil, maybe at the worst. That uncertain feeling is literally about a marriage that's stale. And that film's, maybe that film's single biggest issue is that it doesn't convince me that they've actually fixed it, which is interesting. And to be or not to be, it's about a married couple that is comically dysfunctional. And so I do wonder.
It's easy to forget that part.
Exactly. And I really wonder if, like, that's such a string of pretty downer films about relationships between men and women, but especially in the context of marriage. And I can't help but wonder if Lubitsch's own personal struggles with Vivian, which again lasted from basically the moment they got married until the moment they got divorced in the mid-40s. There's obviously no way to know now. Everyone involved is dead.
If you've done any sort of reading on Lubitsch's life, married to closer readings of his films, I don't think it's unreasonable to suggest that Lubitsch had some hang-ups about women. I think he dealt with them in a lighthearted way. I don't think they often feel too sinister or gross. But there is a sense in a lot of his films that he is, and sometimes in the way that Angel, the film Angel feels, not the character necessarily feels, is I think he feels some sort of distance to women. I think he sees them as slightly unknowable creatures. And I mean, in what film is more about that than Angel?
Where, I mean, in Angel, it feels like she is almost such a mystery that she's a mystery to herself.
Which is amazing because Angel also feels like such a, I don't know, sharp and complex kind of psychological portrait of a woman as well. It's like you feel you know so much about her and yet you don't know much about her, which is that distant, intimate push-pull that we've been talking about in regards to this film. I think, you know, it's in every pore of it.
This is around the time when he stopped making films about the men in this case that he wanted to be, which is this, you know, witty continental ladies man to the people that he was, which is, you know, shop around the corner. It's a much more down to earth. I mean, for all he, you know, revolutionized the depiction of the rake on screen, he was not that. He was forever this, you know, rather schlubby, comical man. I don't want to blow it out of proportion and make it sound like he had some existential crisis over this. He just was like the rest of us. He struggled with his own self-image.
This is ahead of schedule, I guess, but like Heaven Can Wait sort of feels like an existential crisis. I mean, it is an existential, I mean, it's a movie about an existential crisis reflecting on existence. Yeah, he's a complicated relationship with relationships.
And yet he and his writers, who it should be noted, all his writers were men, were shockingly good at writing complex women. And they were much less consistent in writing, for example, convincing young male leads.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the old Lubitsch. It's, if there's a single thing that dogged him throughout his career until he really figured it out later on, it's that often the most boring part of his films were the young male leads. He could write old guys who were, you know, sexless, but he had a hard time writing until he met Maurice.
Until he met Maurice. And then there's obviously younger Herbert Marshall. I mean, he's playing a very different kind of character in Angel, but in, you know, Trouble in Paradise, he's playing.
Yeah. I think of Robert Stack in To Be or Not to Be as the moment that maybe he kind of finally figured out how to do a young, sexy guy, because the answer is make him a completely sincere dolt.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's... Although some similarities to the lieutenant in the Wildcat, but that's obviously the best version of it, in my opinion.
Also, the mere casting of Robert Stack at that age does a lot of the heavy lifting. In 1942, there aren't many men much younger or sexier than Robert Stack.
I'm going to double down on that objectification of Robert Stack and say that the man looked so good in Airplane.
Oh, yeah.
I can't believe that 38 years separates those films, because that man aged like wine.
And I think he knew that.
We quickly touched upon Herbert Marshall, and I want to kind of make amends for an earlier statement I said, in that I think I've given a bit of short shrift to his character and the way it's handled, because for as much as I'm not that invested in him as a romantic lead, I don't think the film asks that of us. Because what I kept thinking of, in many ways, he is the Edward Everett Horton character in this movie. And I don't mean the specific servant he plays. I mean, he's more the Edward Everett Horton character of Trouble in Paradise and Design for Living, where he is defined by one thing, and that is his cloistered cluelessness. You have that great scene where he gets up and kind of becomes distracted mid-argument or mid-discussion with Dietrich by a telegram, and he goes, oh no, it's not Paris that worries me, oh no. And she thinks that something's really wrong, and he goes, it's Yugoslavia.
What's worrying you? France?
No. Yugoslavia.
And that's a comic beat. That's not the exact type of beat, but that's in line with the beats of, for example, the Horton character in Design for Living, where his whole character is that he says he wants a romance, but he's really much more of a company man who cares about his career. And in this case, that's the beat we hit upon again and again for Herbert Marshall, which is that he is so preoccupied with a much more dignified career than just like the ad man in Design for Living. But, you know, and it's made clear that he's doing important things.
Yeah.
It's almost like a superhero thing. He has to, his personal life has to suffer for his good of the League of Nations, that wonderful institution. But he is constantly clueless.
I think maybe even more to that point is like the moment we see him at his most, I guess, sort of engaged with his love for Marlena is when she's asleep and doesn't know what's happening. When he comes home after his trip early on and sees her, probably one of the most beautifully shot, I guess, sequences in the film is like seeing through the mirror, the reflection in the mirror, her empty bed. He's like, oh, she's gone. And then he gets to his own bedroom. Again, they don't even, I mean, it's not even mentioned explicitly, but like it's a marriage where they're already sleeping in separate beds, yet he goes to her bedroom first when he comes home to see where she is, what she's doing, maybe even to get into bed with her if she was there. And when he sees that she's not there, he goes to his own room, sees that she's there, and has this like beautiful, just kind of, he gazes at her so lovingly.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not even awake to, you know, see it, appreciate it, recognize it. And maybe, like, if she had woken up and seen him looking at her like that, maybe a lot of that would have, like, jump-started a conversation that would have, you know, ended the whole movie, the whole mystery of and kind of tension of the movie. I find that such a fascinating reversal of what his character, how he's usually characterized as sort of absent and, I don't know, unfeeling, not in a malicious way, but just sort of a benign unfeelingness.
I think Herbert Marshall is so well cast at this point in his life. I mean, he's as well cast in 1932 as the suavest man in the world.
Boy, does he look haggard in this movie. Oh, man. In a perfect way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the dark side of that is that, I mean, I think he was already struggling with alcoholism at this point because of his constant pain from his war injuries. I mean, the man had one leg. And I wrote in my notes, I always write like last minute, night before viewing notes whenever I do these episodes. I wrote one where the bags under his eyes deserve a screen credit.
Yes.
And like in his close-ups, he looks 15 years older than he did in Trouble in Paradise.
Oh, yeah.
Even with the soft style that Lang is using, this is not like a, this is a film with softening filters at the wazoo, and yet it cannot help Herbert. But it's so perfect. It's this man who is, has the weight of the world literally on his shoulders, and he's out of energy for his own life.
That's, I think, a crucial bit of characterization, even though it's not, I don't know how much makeup they were doing to emphasize that or bring that into play, but it is characterization, however you look at it. And it's a beautiful way to, you know, keep some sympathy from the audience for him and to not make it such a one-sided, for lack of a better term, affair. Lubitsch, you know, makes sure not to neglect, you know, the Herbert Marshall's character, because I think to do so would be a disservice to the story he's trying to tell.
I think that of the three characters, it's the Melvin Douglas character that I have the hardest time describing. You know, for as much as it feels like culture has moved past Mr. Plinkett, the Plinkett test is great, which is describe the character without describing their appearance or their job. And I have a hard time, other than Smoldering Other Man, with Melvin Douglas.
Smoldering, I think, is generous.
Well, I mean, I tend to be much more pro Melvin Douglas than most. I think he's generally very good. I quite like him. I tell you, I'm going to make the argument for him. I think he smolders in this movie. There's so many close-ups where the way that Lang lights him, this perfect, you know, kind of far side key lighting and just the stillness. I mean, if nothing else, Melvin Douglas is a great meat puppet for which for the filmmakers to imprint upon at the very least. And I think that's giving Melvin Douglas too little credit. I think he does very well in this. And I do think that if there's any reservations I have about his character, it's that maybe he's not quite well sketched enough as his own man to be kind of a distinct alternative other than just he's the alternative.
Exactly. I think the film could have benefited from not necessarily stronger romantic pull, like a romantic pull between him and Marlena, because I think that would have, I mean, knocked the film out of balance. But yeah, I think a little bit more depth and complexity to his actual character would have done a lot of that work without knocking the romantic sense out of balance.
He's the only one we don't really know outside the context of this film. We get the backstory of the war, but it doesn't really like inform him because it's so long ago. Like, I can't really say, okay, what's he like when you're hanging out with him?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's in the William Paul excerpts you sent me, they talk about a bit of the adaptation, like the source material that Angels came from, a Hungarian romantic comedy, in which a lot of things are different. One of them being that the Herbert Marshall character and the Melvin Douglas character were actually like close personal friends rather than these, you described them as old war buddies, but that describes the relationship a little bit too closely. They're people who fought in the fought in the same war.
Old guys who met in the war once. Yeah, they went to the same brothel, basically. Yeah,
they went to the same brothel and never actually met. They just know the nicknames that the sex worker they both frequented gave them. So yes. Yeah, the relationship is tenuous. And I think if there was more detail or a more solid connection between them, the two of them, I don't know what that would have done to this film. It would have made it a little bit more tragic, and I don't think that would have served the film well.
I had forgotten about the detail that they had not met, but had frequented the same brothel.
Yeah.
Because Lubitsch does such a great job at burying all that into the subtext. I mean,
yeah.
A significant amount of this film takes place at the Grand Duchess's place of business. It is never said what it is, but it is obviously a brothel. You know, men play games there and she arranges meetings with women and it is never named.
It's described generally as like a salon.
Exactly. It's a salon that happens to have women who you pay for accompaniment. Even saying paying, I'm inferring there, but it's clear that the film is meant, you know, and even just Angel's backstory, right? Or Maria's backstory, it's clear that she used to work there. And it is never explicitly said. You could easily go through the film, and if you were to give everything the kind of reverse benefit of the doubt, she could just be someone who knows the Grand Duchess and maybe was like a bartender there. You know, it's so obscure. Yeah. It's subterranean, the subtext.
I think that's what I thought the very first time I watched it. Yeah, I think like what you said is giving it like the benefit of the doubt, which seems like the wrong way to describe it. Because as if like I disapprove of like whatever, but like I think that's how I approached or read it the very first time I watched it.
It's such an oddity, right, in so many ways, where it's a film where everything about it is so buried, so obscure. Everything is, I mean, it's so underplayed that even after watching it last night, it feels like a film that fades in my memory faster than most Lubitsch's. Mm. And usually I mean that as a criticism. I don't in this case. It feels like a film designed to be experienced in the moment and then kind of to exist as kind of this weird cloud in your memory of what actually happened there.
Yeah.
I can't quite recall. And I've seen it 3 times now, and yet it's already escaping me.
Well, I don't even want to admit how many times I've seen it. But yeah, but I understand that feeling. Angel provides its own sort of refresh that others don't. I haven't seen To Be or Not to Be in like a long time, but it's so distinctly in my memory, whereas Angel sort of slips away from you.
It's interesting to note that To Be or Not to Be, I think, is like 7 or 8 minutes longer than Angel.
Yeah.
And it feels like so much shorter than it is, because nothing happens in this movie. There's like 3 plot points in this whole movie, whereas To Be or Not to Be, each of its 3 major acts, more happens than in this whole film. It's very interesting.
And talk about a film I needed to watch a few times to just understand what was happening.
Yes. I mean, To Be or Not to Be is so wonderfully kind. It's maybe his greatest structural experiment ever.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I don't want to set myself up for like embarrassment or failure, but in your notes, in your big document, you're like, ask Chris about why this is a radical feminist text. And I do want to like, I don't know, maybe temper that assumption a little bit. I re-listened to my episode with Olympia, who's like a good friend. In the many times I've seen Angel, it feels like just such an anomaly in terms of just how much agency it affords the central female character. Like I said earlier, it's a film about her provoking the men in her life, which feels rare. And it doesn't punish her, the traditional kind of punishment that you see in these post-code classical Hollywood films.
Even in Desire. I mean, Desire has, my least favorite part of that movie is the ending where Dietrich has to, you know, in my opinion, very unsatisfying way, kind of accept punishment for her crimes.
Yeah, the ending of Desire is where it really lost me in the end.
Lubitsch, it would be a very big stretch to call him like a feminist in the 2023 sense. I mean, no one, by definition, no one alive in his period basically at least in the mainstream, right?
Yeah, in the mainstream, yeah.
In like, you know, polite society, you might say, but there were obviously radicals throughout history and they have been, you know, unjustifiably marginalized even in the telling of that history. So, but I think a current throughout Lubitsch's career that I find nice is the fact that he seemed to not have that impulse to punish or shame characters for their transgressions, especially their sexual ones.
Yeah.
And especially in a time when, I mean, I'm thinking of all the other films where the women have to get punished for their sexual transgressions, basically as soon as the coat hits. Even stuff like Christmas in Connecticut is a film that I watched a few months ago with Barbara Stanwyck. It's a good film in many ways. Stanwyck is great, but basically the film is she's a very career-oriented woman.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the Hallmark script where she, due to wacky circumstances, she ends up with a down-home country lad, a good guy. I believe he's a, you know, he's like a veteran, you know, and he's the most boring man. And she kind of has to pay for her sins of ambition by like becoming a housewife in the end, the person that she pretended to be the whole time, but ends up, you know, wanting to make babies and having it, you know. And even in the films where I think that they to a fault are just like, I call it the dead queen films of the Berlin era. I never get the sense that he's punishing the women in those films, even though I'd rather they live. I'd rather he rewrite history.
Yeah.
But it's more that there are these melodramas that have to end in a big flourish.
Yeah.
Later on, at a time like in the 40s, when it feels like every other Hollywood director was had almost this like bloodlust for, you know, putting anyone who's not the ambitious white guy in their place. The women in his films, Carol Lombard and To Be or Not to Be, she's never punished or shamed for her affairs. In fact, the final beat of the film is her carrying on a new affair.
Yeah.
And the men are shocked, but I don't think we're meant to find it at all disagreeable. It's just that that's who she is. Or Ninotchka, she's never asked to renounce her Bolshevism. You know, she embraces silliness. I mean, actually, I wish I had this word in my mind when I recorded that episode. I recorded it like 8 months ago. But the James Harvey writes that it's about someone who learns to recognize the value of silliness. It's not that she learns to recognize the value of capitalism or that Bolshevism is a lie. It's that she learns not to take life so seriously.
Yeah.
That's her arc. And I find that beautiful compared to what almost any other director would have done with that.
In terms of Ninotchka, I mean, the real emotional core is that dinner reunion back in Russia, rather than the romantic reunion with her and Melvin Douglas. The real emotional core is with her Russian buddies. So
she has to go back to her emotionally repressed state, right?
Yeah.
The joke of that scene is that they have to share eggs to make an omelet, but it isn't really about the omelet. It's about their lack of ability to kind of live their own lives and be their true selves.
That is still infused with such, you know, love and affection and camaraderie.
They have their own little community now. She finally has people who know her, and she at least has that comfort. Well, I'll say thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a great experience. I think I'm going to like put Angel to bed for a while for myself. I think I'm going to like not watch it for a long time so I can, like Maria, be able to reignite this relationship down the line.
Next week, Olympia Kyriakou joins us to discuss Bluebeard's Eighth Wife. Head over to ErnstCast.com for information as to where you might find the films we'll be discussing this season and other resources such as show notes and our Discord server. How Would Lubitsch Do It is a production of Moving Image Agency. Sophia Yoon was our dialogue editor for this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you happen to use. It helps other people find our podcast and therefore find Ernst Lubitsch. We'd like to acknowledge that this podcast was produced on the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples.